Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is day five of our Iditarod coverage for the 2013 race. And on the line is our co-host during Iditarod time, calling in from sunny California, filmmaker and writer of Mush the Movie, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are you doing up in Alaska?
We are doing well. It's an absolutely beautiful day. We have sunshine in March. We are heading towards spring. And you know what Iditarod means? It means that winter is almost over and spring is around the corner.
Absolutely. And I feel like we are, I said this last night, but I still feel like we're a little bit upside down here because it's been actually rainy and cold, well, relatively cold for Los Angeles and dreary all day today while you were out enjoying the sunshine.
You know, Mike and I are sitting here in the studio here at KVRF in short sleeve shirts, so something has to say about that Alaska weather.
That sounds good. And speaking of weather, I know there's a big storm system that's coming in, and it's expected to bring, I've heard different reports about whether it's going to be a cold storm or a warm storm, but what we do know is that it's expected to have some heavy winds coming in, winds possibly of 50 to 75 miles per hour on parts of the trail. So that is certainly going to play a role in the next 24 to 48 hours.
That can play havoc on a musher and his dog team. If it's blowing that hard, it makes mushing pretty dang hard, especially in those open areas.
Yeah, and one of the weather reports I saw, and again, weather forecasting, I guess, is still an inexact science, especially in Alaska, but one report I saw called for temperatures of possibly into the lower 50s along parts of the trail, which is absurdly warm.
That is. That's almost hot enough where you might have to run around in shorts and definitely short sleeves out there on the trail.
Yeah, and I had read, I believe it was Joe Runyon's blog on the Iditarod website where he was talking about a lot of mushers prepare for possible rain or drizzle or sleety conditions in the early part of the race and then will leave their rain gear after they get past the Alaska range because they don't, because in the past there has never been any threat of rain past that early part of the course.
Right, right. So we are in day four of the Iditarod, day five of our coverage, and there's a race shaping up. We have a couple of mushers that have officially taken their 24. I'm sure several others are in the process of doing so. As of right now, Lance Mackey is in first place in Ophir, Sonny Linder in second, Jeff King in third, Jake Berkowitz in fourth, and Nicholas Pettit in fifth. And then old school musher in his 70s, Jim Lanier, is in sixth place. What do you think about the old man showing how it's done?
You know, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Jim Lanier. He's a really terrific guy, always willing to spend time with you, and always, always will point out that he has now run the Iditarod in five different decades. I believe he ran his first race in either 78 or 79. So he ran in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s, and has run the past few years as well.
You know, I got a chance to meet Jim Lanier at the Willow Junior 100 race, a race that my daughter took part in, and he was the honorary musher for that race. And one thing he said, Vern Halter puts it on, perennial Iditarod musher back in the 80s and 90s. He said, usually an honorary musher is only honorary after he's dead. And he asked Vern if he was asking him, if he was telling him something.
Yeah.
Pretty funny story.
You know, yeah, absolutely. Speaking of the standings, Martin Boozer, who, of course, took sort of stood the race up on a deer with his early run, his early basically 24-hour run with minimal rest, and then took his 24 in Roan. He is off of his 24, so he won't have to stop to do his 24, and he's already moved up into eighth place.
Wow.
Since he started again, a lot of people were speculating that maybe he would have a similar sort of long run. Instead, what he's been doing is having a series of shorter runs followed, shorter but still respectably long runs, followed by 4 to 5 hour rests. So if he sticks with that schedule, it looks like he probably will be leaving Ophir in the next 2 to 3 hours.
And I know he took his 24 with a young man that was running his B team, or what we said the other day, a mix of the B and the A team, now that his son Roan withdrew from the race. And it looks like Matt Failer, I believe is how you pronounce his last name, is still in
right.
McGrath, or that was his last checkpoint. So he's fallen behind a little bit from Martin. I'm sure they didn't have the exact same race strategy. You know, the champ is not going to tell all the secrets to the kid.
Exactly. But he is doing very, very well, very respectable, middle of the pack performance. And he has a chance also to catch up with a lot of the teams that are currently taking their 24s. There are a lot of teams in Takotna, which is a very popular place for mushers to camp out for 24 hours. It's very well known in Iditarod circles for having amazing hospitality and great food, which is brought to mushers whenever they want it, and they have steaks and homemade pies and moose stew and all sorts of things. So there are a lot of teams that have been in Takotna and are apparently taking their 24 there.
It looks like, from what I see on the standings, about 25 teams in Takotna, either in Takotna or in their last checkpoint, with the top nine in Ophir or on their way to leave Ophir. And then several mushers, of course, are still in McGrath and followed all the way down to Cindy Abbott, who is in Nicolai. It's currently in 64th place and last place. But, you know, I wanted to bring up something. We talked a little bit about it off air, about speed. We got a Twitter question last night, if we could talk a little bit about that. And a lot of people don't understand about the speed of the Iditarod. And just for an example, it shows here on the standings that Lance Mackey, his current speed or his overall speed at this point is 9.45 miles an hour, whereas the slowest speed on the trail right now is Cindy Abbott at 3.97 miles an hour, about three times faster than Cindy. Lance is. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, and I apologize. This is not a commercial for the Iditarod Insider, but the Insider has this a bunch of new features on their GPS tracker this year, including very, very detailed statistics. So if race fans are interested in that, it costs some money, which does go to support the Iditarod, but there's a lot of information you can get from that. And I'm looking at it now, and among other things, they have run and rest statistics, which is new this year. So, for example, Lance Mackey, his average speed when he's moving has been 8.4 miles per hour. And compare that to Cindy Abbott's average speed when she's been moving is 7.6 miles per hour, which is slower and is about what you'd expect. The reason for the very low overall average speed is that she's taken a lot of rest. So she's taken a lot of time at checkpoints, and obviously when you're not moving, that lowers your average quite a bit.
Right, and just to let people know from a musher's perspective, a long-distance mushing team with this rest calculated in, it's about 7, 7.5, 8 miles an hour on the trail. That's a pretty good clip for a long-distance mushing team, and Lance is well-known for his very speedy dogs, and typically that's why he does so well in these long-distance races, the Iditarod, the Yukon Quest, and things like that.
Yeah, and Lance is known for a number of things, including being very well in tune with his dogs and how and what their capabilities are. And he always likes to run his dogs at the top range of their capabilities, but he's very familiar with each and every one of his dogs and never pushes them past what they can do.
You know, that brings up a great point. Another thing that you and I talked about off air was Ramey Smith, a perennial Iditarod favorite, has been in the top five many times. He's came very close to winning the race, including last year with a very, very fast third place finish, not too far behind Ali Zirkel and Dallas Seaview when they came in first and second, Dallas winning the race last year. But something happened to him today, talking about being in tune and pushing your dogs to the limit that the musher knows what it is. What happened to Ramey today?
Well, Ramey had one of his lead dogs pulled from the race and by a veterinarian who said that the dog had an elevated heartbeat. And Ramey, and obviously we weren't there, so it's hard to know exactly what went on, but Ramey said that it was a vet who was on his first year on the Iditarod, and he spooked the dog, and that was why the dog's heart rate was elevated. And he has said that he's going to file an official protest. However, he can't do that until he gets to Nome, and in any event, no matter what happens with the protest, he's not going to get the dog back. So he was very upset about that and said that this effectively means that he is not going to have a competitive finish, that he's not going to be challenging up with the leaders. And also, I should remind people that Ramey Smith is known for having very, very fast finishes on the coast. There's an award that the Iditarod gives for the fastest time from safety to Nome, and he has won that seven different times.
Wow. Yeah, you often find Ramey running in running shoes on the trail in the last sections of the race. I mean, he does a very long distance as a runner, not only as a musher, but he is in tip-top shape. He and I have crossed paces on the trail many a times. He lives right down the road from me. He's one heck of an athlete off the dog sled as well as on. But, you know, one thing that we need to mention here, Alex, is a lot of people, especially mushing fans that aren't, you know, aren't hardcore fans, don't know a lot about the sport, they always think that a musher has one lead dog, that you know, that dog in literature, the Balto and the Togo and, you know, Lance Mackey, Zorro and all of the, and Larry and all these dogs that have been come to known as the great dog on the team, the leader of the team. And that's not necessarily so. Typically, a musher will have several dogs that can lead. It's very important that you do, but you always have that core group of leaders, whether it's one or two or three. But a musher is often at a handicap if he only has or he relies on just one or two dogs that can take him to Nome, because you never know what's going to happen, whether they get yanked from the race like what happened to Ramey, or an injury or something of that nature. I mean, just the other day with Scott Jansen, his leader, with dehydration, you know, that's what happened to him. He had to turn around because his leader was dehydrated and pretty much quit on the race.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of mushers will have different dogs who are really good leaders in certain situations. So they'll have one dog who's a great leader for going uphill, or they'll have a dog who's a really good leader around the water, or another one who's particularly good on the coast. So all of those things go into the mixture of the dog team.
Right, and another misconception, just when we're talking about leaders here for a second, often people think that the leader is the alpha dog of the kennel or of the team. It's the dog that lives in the house and gets preferential treatment and rides in the dog truck and sleeps in the sleeping bag with the musher. That's not the case always either. It's not necessarily the toughest, the biggest, the baddest dog in the kennel or on the team. Right now I'm running a young dog that I got from Iditarod and Yukon Quest musher, Hugh Neff, and she's one of the smallest dogs in my team. She weighs about 35 pounds, and she knows how to lead like nobody's business. So it's not always the biggest or the most intimidating or the alpha dog in the team either.
It's an interesting combination of traits that go into making a really good leader. And I think different mushers have different strategies, but you want to make sure that you're working with a number of different dogs and essentially teaching and training them how to be leaders.
That's exactly right. Can we, as we're talking about dogs, and I know we'll probably talk about this again, but can we talk a little bit about positions just for a second? We have about 15 minutes, and I want to get to our featured musher this evening, but I want to go quickly down the line of positions from front to back, if we can, Alex.
Sure, absolutely.
So the first two dogs, and it's very common that a team will have two dogs in lead. Those are the leaders. Right behind the leaders, those are the swing dogs. Those are typically the dogs that are working their way up to become first-class leaders. Typically, it's dogs that are learning the ropes, so to speak. After the swing dogs, you have a group of team dogs. In Iditarod, you would have approximately 12 team dogs. And then right behind the team dogs, right in front of the sled, are the wheel dogs. And I like to tell folks that I'm teaching about mushing, the quarterbacks of the team are typically the leaders, and the grunts or the offensive linemen of the team are the wheel dogs. They're typically the bigger, broodier, heavier, more muscle-bound dogs. They're the big boys of the team, not necessarily boys, but the big dogs of the team, because they're taking that first brute of the weight of the sled right there in front of the team. And just a perspective, in a typical Iditarod team, it's about 8 feet between each set of dogs. So if you have 16 dogs, math here real quick, what is that, Alex, do you know? Eight times eight? 64 feet, right?
64 feet plus the sled.
Plus the sled. So your leaders plus the length of the lead dogs, which is about 2 feet, is about 64 to 70 feet in front of you. And those dogs are very in tune to what that musher's saying, whether they're saying gee-haw, whoa, stop, hike, hup up, whatever you're saying. So that's approximately 70 feet in front of them. And we talked just a second ago about windstorms. Just imagine in a windstorm where those leaders have to listen to those commands that far back.
Right. And in addition to that, occasionally dogs will get tangled up, or the lines will get tangled and the musher will have to stop and untangle the dogs. And at times if you take a wrong turn and you go down the wrong path, or your dogs want to go in one direction and you have to change direction or turn them around, that is a fairly complicated thing. A lot of people think of, well, it's just a dog sled, so you can turn it around fairly easily, but it's more like one or two Greyhound buses that you're turning around.
I've told my kids many a times when I'm teaching them how to turn around on the team, it's like parallel parking a semi-truck is what it's like when you're trying to turn that dog team around on a very narrow trail, especially in the trees. It is a very difficult task, and many a teams are lost at that point when you're trying to turn them around. You get them turned around, and all of a sudden they're taking off on you because you've got to get your butt back to the sled, and there they go down the trail.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about our featured musher. We've showcased four of them already. Last night was Aaron Peck. A couple of nights ago, very popular interview with Cindy Abbott. Who is this evening?
This evening is Dr. Christine Roloffs, who is 46, and she is a pediatric dentist, a dentist for children. She was born in Ohio and grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. Went to dental school in Buffalo, New York, and then practiced at the Children's Hospital in Buffalo. In 1999, she moved to Wasilla, Alaska, and intended to only stay for a couple of years and then was going to move back to Kentucky. But as often happens when people go up to Alaska, she fell in love with it and really enjoyed the lifestyle and the scenery. She travels around the state for several weeks at a time, doing dentistry for bush communities and very rural communities where there is not a where they don't have access to a dentist who lives there full time. And she began mushing in 2006 after she had been a volunteer for several years for the Iditarod, and she just fell in love with the sport and got the racing bug, and she started building her own team, mostly with dogs that she had bought or gotten from other mushers, but then she started having a couple of litters of her own. And one of the more interesting things about her is that she is an urban musher, so to speak. She lives in Anchorage. She has a kennel of about 22 dogs out by Merrill Field, which is near the university, if people are familiar with Anchorage. And she was mentored in her mushing development and her mushing education by Sue Allen, who is in Mush the Movie and who we've spoken about before. AK Rhythm Magazine, which is a photography magazine in Alaska, is doing a feature documentary about her or starring her called Iditarod to the Starting Line, which covers everything involving training and everything that goes on in the preparation of getting to the starting line of Iditarod, and I guess we'll end with her leaving to go on the trail. She is there. She was in the news briefly today. Apparently, on the way to Roan, she lost control of her team, and her sled got away from her. And Mikhail Telpin, who is the Russian musher, gave her a lift to recover her sled, which is allowed under the rules if a musher has lost their team or lost their sled. And the other interesting thing about her is that she is one of two mushers, and I apologize ahead of time for even mentioning this, but she's one of two mushers who is testing a product called Pea Pants, which was developed by someone who then tried to get in touch with all of the female mushers that he could who were running Iditarod, which is a product that is described as a mixture of bike shorts and a funnel and a tube so that you you do not have to stop on the trail to relieve yourself. You can just, I guess, do it while you are continuing down the trail.
You know, we had a discussion about that at one of the symposiums up here in Alaska, and that is a very detail-oriented procedure for ladies, and they've come up with all sorts of ways, because just imagine, guys and gals, how difficult it is for a lady to relieve herself out on the trail. You know, for us guys, as you know, it's a relatively easy task to take part in, but for the ladies, it's a little bit more difficult, especially if it's 50 below zero and you have on 4, 5, 6 layers of clothing. That is a very difficult task. So I've heard about this test that they're doing with the pea pants. I would love to hear more about it and maybe have a woman musher on a future mushing radio show to talk about that. Maybe Christine, or I know Angie Taggart is another one of those mushers,
right,
that is testing that. You know, one other thing about Christine is that since she is an urban musher, she has to truck her dogs for every single training run up to Wasilla or further north. For folks that don't live in Alaska, that is about a 45-minute trip just to find ample snow or ample trails to run your dogs on. And, you know, that's a big deal for a lady that has a full-time job. I'm sure she has a family and all that. But to truck your dogs for every single training run up to Wasilla, Willow, Talkeetna, those trails that we have up here, that adds another full-time job onto what you're already doing, as I'm sure is a very, very busy pediatric dentist.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, although there are some trails in Anchorage proper, they are much, much shorter trails. So when you're training for a long distance race, you want to be able to take the dogs on fairly long runs. You don't want to be stuck doing runs that are 5 or 10 miles. You want the dogs to get used to running for, 50 or 60 miles.
That's exactly right. And one of our primary reasons for moving to Alaska was access to trails. We used to live in Denver, Colorado, and the time it would take to drive from our home in Denver to ample trails was 2, 3, or 4 hours. Now we have trails through our backyard, and that's what we're here for. And that's why a lot of the mushers do so well in Alaska, because we have access to those trails.
Right, and it's no coincidence that mushers tend to gravitate towards the areas where they can basically go out their back door and be on a trail in a minute or two. And that's why there are so many mushers in places like Willow and some other places where you are right on a fairly substantial trail system.
That's right. We have close to probably 200-300 miles of trails right from our back door, and that's very similar to how it is on, as you said, Willow, Tok, up near Fairbanks, Two Rivers, where the top mushers live is where the access to the trails are. Alex, we have about 2.5 minutes left. What else is on tap?
Just a couple quick things I wanted to mention. Apparently this year the steps and the Dalzell Gorge were in relatively good condition, but the Farewell Burn was very, very rough. And we've gotten a lot of reports that teams were coming in with sleds that were very badly beaten up, sleds held together by clamps and duct tape. So a lot of the mushers who had shipped a second sled to McGrath or to other places along the trail are going to be switching out their sleds. Those who only have one sled will have to make do and make repairs. Lance Mackey looks like he is on his way to Iditarod, which is the first musher into Iditarod wins the Dorothy Page Halfway Prize. There's been some speculation about whether Lance is going to take his 24 in Iditarod or if he's going to try to push on to Anvik, which is the first checkpoint on the Yukon.
And just one point about those busted-up sleds. Last year I was at Iditarod headquarters picking up Hugh Neff's sled during the race. And I tell you what, those sleds that were shipped back to Iditarod headquarters, it looked like a sled junkyards back there with all those sleds just busted up and torn apart, probably from that Farewell Burn area or accidents there on the steps or the gorge.
Yeah, and what people may not realize is that the a sled that a team will take on the Iditarod is a relatively lightweight and relatively simple piece of equipment. And it can, if you hit a tree or if you hit, a log or something, you can really mess up part of the sled.
That's exactly right, and they are not cheap either. A professional Iditarod quality sled is anywhere from about $1,500 to close to $3,000 if they are not made by the musher themselves. So a very expensive piece of equipment as well.
Yeah, and so that's also part of the reason why some of the mushers who are not as well capitalized or don't have as much in terms of their own money or sponsorship money will try to sometimes get by without having a backup sled.
And sometimes that's why they have to scratch when that sled is deteriorated to a condition where it can't be ridden again. Alex, we're just about out of time. Anything else?
That's pretty much it for today. I think we're all looking forward to seeing what's going to happen as the rest of the field comes off their 24s, a lot of them this evening and overnight, and Martin Boozer continues burning up the trail.
There you go. We'll see you guys next time. Robert Forto on behalf of our co-host Alex Stein. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Goodbye.